Welcome to Future Makers, cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading researchers at the University of Oxford, recorded here in the Thomas Hobbes Room at Hertford College. I'm Peter Milliken, Professor of Philosophy, and our first series is all about artificial intelligence. In 2013, two Oxford academics published a paper entitled The Future of Employment: How Susceptible Are Jobs to Computerization? They estimated that 47% of US jobs were at risk of automation. Since then, numerous other studies have emerged, arriving at various different conclusions. So why do these estimates diverge? And where do we think the automation of jobs might be heading? With me to discuss this topic are Professor Mike Osborne, one of the authors of that 2013 paper, Dr. Judy Stevenson, a junior research fellow in economic history and an expert on labour markets in pre-industrial England, and Professor David Clifton from the Department of Engineering Science, whose research focuses on machine learning for monitoring complex systems from jet engines to healthcare. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Mike, do you want to kick us off on this one? What is AI already capable of, and which areas of employment are already changing as a result?
Right. So, I mean, the interesting thing about AI today is not so much what it's already capable of, but just the trajectory of its progress, right? So working in the field of machine learning myself, it's been an absolutely thrilling ride over the last several years with kind of staggering advance following on from staggering advance. So the paper that you mentioned back in 2013 really resulted from, you know, me sitting in the field, seeing what was going on, and Carl Frey, my co-author, coming along and wanting to speak to what actually that might mean for the world of employment.
But there have been quite a few challenges since then. I mean, other figures have been produced that suggest that some of your conclusions may be open to challenge.
Certainly there have been studies that have followed on from our original one. All of them so far have been based off the same data that we gathered back in 2013. So the differences are actually more in how that data was analysed and interpreted than in the original data itself, it seems like.
Okay. So, can you summarise roughly what your results were? I mean, what implications they have for different areas of employment and so forth?
The first thing to say about our study is that it tackled only the simple problem of, well, simpler problem, I should say, of to what degree technological change will enable jobs potentially to be automated by the year of 2030 or so. Crucially, what we weren't aiming to tackle was the question of what jobs will be automated, which is, of course, not just a function of technological change, but of all the other things going on in labour markets, be it demographic change and immigration and changing patterns of trade and so on and so forth. So, you know, we thought to make this into a tractable problem, we'll focus just on the technology, the thing with which at least I'm most familiar. And so the number was that 47% of current US employment is at high risk of being automatable rather than automated by the year 2030 or so.
So you didn't consider at all how likely it was that it actually would be automated. Is that part of the reason for the divergence in opinions over your conclusions?
I think it's certainly part of the reason for the divergence in public perception of the numbers, in that people are over-interpreting the numbers, thinking them to mean something that they're not. So all of the subsequent studies have tackled, in fact, the same research question. You know, what is the technological scope of automation rather than what actually will be automated?
There are a lot of jobs that involve a combination of different skills. Some of those could more easily be taken over by computers than others. So how did you deal with that?
So this was another differentiator between our original study and ones that have followed. So our unit of analysis was an occupation, and the numbers we arrived at were the probabilities of those occupations being automatable over this time horizon. Subsequent studies have instead focused on tasks, and of course an occupation will do a number of different tasks, and have made the claim that that is a more valid unit of analysis, in that, of course, only some fraction of tasks within an occupation may become automated. My thoughts on this are several. Firstly, we did try to get the participants in our original workshop to think about the task composition of occupations. And the question we posed was, will most or all of those tasks be automated? It's also important to note that, in fact, not all of the tasks within an occupation need to be automated for that occupation to nonetheless see, you know, fairly significant change. One example is perhaps that of the typing pool of the 1950s. In which workers were certainly typing things, but also using a range of other skills, performing different tasks like taking dictation, perhaps making coffee, all this kind of other things. at the end of the day, when word processing software came along that was capable only of doing the first of those tasks, so producing documents in a more efficient way, it wasn't even, of course, capable of tapping fingers on keyboards. The typing pool basically disappeared, even though the technology that existed wasn't able to do all those other tasks. So I don't think it's enough to look just at tasks. I think we also need to consider occupations.
Mike, you know I'm a big fan of your work, but there's one thing I always wanted to ask you about this. You're mapping, you've got hundreds of features, as we'd say, hundreds of factors about the particular occupations, and then you're learning to map those features onto the labels that the experts have given you. And of course, this approach to AI is only as good as its labels. Mm-hmm. And I'd really like to ask you, how did you go about doing this? I mean, are these tech people telling you what they believe is technologically automatable?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So being a machine learning person myself, like yourself, David, the approach I wanted to take to this problem was indeed one of machine learning. And the way that machine learning works, as you've described, is that a training data set needs to be provided to an algorithm to teach it the patterns that it's to discover. And here, the pattern we wanted to discover was the difference in skills between an occupation that was potentially automatable from one that was not. So we had our experts label occupations as being either canonically automatable or canonically non-automatable. We had them label 70 of around 700 occupations, the idea being that the algorithm would learn from those 70 the skills that were most representative of an occupation being automatable and use that to generalize to the entire data set. Crucially, however, the algorithm wasn't slavishly following the labels that the experts provided. So in some cases, it actually corrected, if you like, some of the assessments they made. One interesting example is that of waiters and waitresses. So in the original discussion, we'd kind of identified that a waiter or waitress at the table of a customer will be performing these quite subtle persuasive actions, right? They might be trying to get the customer to buy a slightly more expensive wine or something like that. And the kind of mood of the room was that that might render these occupations non-automatable. So they went into the training set as an example of one of those canonically non-automatable occupations. Nonetheless, when we turned the handle of the machine learning algorithm, the probability of automation for that occupation, probability of automatability, sorry, to be precise, was 94%. So it came out as actually quite a highly automatable occupation. And the reasons for that were that the skills mix of waiters and waitresses is quite similar to a lot of other occupations that were seen to be automatable. They were relatively routine. And perhaps some of those other things that a waiter or waitress does in our minds are not so important to the job as a whole.
Are there a small number of tasks that would, as you've described, upselling, you know, trying to get me to buy that Chateau Margaux or whatever it is? Is there a particular number of tasks to which a machine learning algorithm might not be sensitive, to which the experts are actually very sensitive?
In at least partial answer to your question, I can say that our algorithm was paying most of its attention to a very small number of the descriptors of an occupation. And the most important of those features was the requirement for an occupation to be original. So the originality score was a very strong predictor of a job susceptibility to automation.
So a question, I suppose, for both of you is, do the adjustments that you've been talking about, do they help the model become any more predictive about which occupations will become automated or not? My understanding is that they don't really, that we don't actually have a method of working out a predictive path for which ones will be and will not. Am I right?
So we can do some degree of validation, and we did what was possible. So one validation exercise we undertook was to partition our data set, our training data set. So we took half of it, that is 35 occupations, trained our algorithm on those 35, and then asked it to predict the 35 held out occupations, those that it had never seen. By and large, it was pretty good at predicting the labels for those held out hidden occupations, given only the 35 that it had, even over multiple repeats, multiple partitions of the data set. So that tells us at the very least that the predictions it was making were self-consistent. So regardless of the subset of the 70 occupations it seen, it saw, it was kind of producing the same results. Of course, that doesn't say whether or not this is well calibrated to reality, whether or not that these are actually occupations that will be automatable. And to some degree, we won't know that until 2030. However, other people have taken our numbers and mapped it onto actual changes in employment over the last 15 years. So there was a study from Deloitte that looked at changes in UK employment between 2000 and 2015, and mapped that onto the probabilities of automatability for UK occupations from our study. And they found a fairly strong correlation. Interestingly, the headline from that study was that while there were 700,000 jobs lost in the occupations that we'd identified as being most automatable, there are actually many more jobs created in the occupations that we'd identified as least automatable, to the tune of 3.5 million new jobs created. So overall, the picture was one of an expanding pie.
Can I just press you on the contrast between jobs and skills? Because suppose you've got a job which involves a number of different skills, and maybe some of those can be automated and some not. It might, of course, be that, as David was hinting, some of the skills that are not automatable are actually particularly crucial to the job, like getting people to actually sign on the dotted line or to buy the more expensive product or whatever. It strikes me that if you've got, say, 45% of jobs that are potentially automatable, it might be that far more than 47% of jobs involve skills as a major part of them, which could be taken away by computers. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it's an all or nothing. There may be a whole range of jobs where, by bringing computers in, you can deal with, let's say, you know, 55% of the task or whatever. And that means effectively you need 55% fewer people, right?
I fully agree that the effects of automation are not limited to some subset of occupations that are deemed to be at highest risk. Of course, the effects will be felt across the entire labour market, exactly as you've suggested. I do agree, actually, that the task level of analysis is also very interesting, but at the same time, I don't think it obviates the need to do something at an occupation level as well. I mean, if you're a worker in one of these occupations, that is, I think, what's of most interest to you.
Presumably what actually happens with these occupations will be determined by the economics of the situation. I mean, if employers see that by automating some significant proportion of a task, they can reduce the number of people they need to employ to carry that task out, that's going to require quite a lot of retraining on the part of those people. It will mean they're in competition for the jobs that remain. It could be pretty disruptive.
Absolutely agreed. I should say, actually, we've done subsequent work which at least goes some way to addressing some of these other factors. So last year we put out a report in collaboration with Pearson and Nesta, which tried to bring together all these big drivers of change in labour markets. It aimed to answer the question not just, you know, which occupations would find themselves at highest risk of automatability, but instead which occupations would see an increase in share of employment over a horizon of 20 years. Would they become a larger part of the employment pie, or would they see more or less demand? And unfortunately, the challenge there is that in trying to consider everything else that's going on, you become a lot less certain, and the recommendations we can make are a little less crisp. But we did at least try to identify the skills that are most closely linked to future demand and those that were not. And in fact, rather than countering our previous work, they seem to only bolster it. So according to this new study, the skills that seem to be most in demand are advanced cognitive skills, by and large. Originality featured quite heavily, as did systems thinking, thinking about how a machine might work alongside a human within a complex organization. Social intelligence was another very important skill.
Going from all that, both your own results and those that have come out since, who do you think should be most worried in the labour market?
Right. So by and large, it's routine occupations thought of in the sense of doing things that a machine learning algorithm might be able to do given a sufficient data set. So anywhere that your job is mostly about processing information or making routine decisions for which a really crisp data set could be gathered that would enable an algorithm to reproduce exactly those activities, I think there's, you know, a high degree of concern.
Can you be more specific about which particular jobs those would be?
Tax preparers is an occupation that's already at risk. Call centre workers might see their jobs affected by new technologies like Google Duplex and the subsequent product it's indeed offering to call centres. Google Duplex, for listeners who might not have heard of it, is this algorithm that's able to produce really realistic voice synthesis. It sounds exactly like a human, which might be able to take on some of the very early stages of a call centre conversation. Accountants and auditors, slightly higher up the skill spectrum, also involve a lot of this kind of routine processing of information and might find themselves at risk.
We're in the part where we're talking about what AI can do, and we're both in the field, and I wonder if we're a little bit, although by definition we're optimistic, I wonder if what AI can do is actually a little bit more prosaic than what the press is describing. It's the kind of things that we're talking about doing are just components of one occupation. It's not like one occupation generally comprises one task. And so even with the call center worker, you know, both of us are very familiar with what's possible in natural language processing and synthesis. And I imagine it would be quite a while, even before your favorite call center is automated, simply because of the very prosaic nature of what can be done and the faults that arise and so forth.
So I fully agree with everything you've just said, David. It is important to recognize there's an enormous amount of hype in machine learning right now, and we shouldn't necessarily believe all the claims that are made of algorithms, certainly not the extent to which they might entirely substitute for existing occupations. But for me, it's also important to keep in mind that the way that automation really takes root is not in providing a one-for-one replacement for a human worker, but instead enabling a task to be redesigned, to be simpler, to kind of make it more suitable for an automation technology. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see. So an example is that of warehousing work. If you think about what a picker in an Amazon warehouse was required to do, say, 5-10 years ago, they would walk around the warehouse and take objects off shelves and then take them back to a central position. This is still very often what happens. When Amazon acquired Kiva Robotics, there was this realization that you could substitute for at least the movement around the warehouse part of that work in placing robots under the shelving units that would transport the entire thing to a place that was more convenient for a picker, a human worker, to access. That's by and large how automation has always taken place. We've always found ways to redesign, to simplify a task, to make the technology more suitable for doing it.
I think for me, that's why technology is not worrying. I mean, the hype around machine learning and AI is so vast that people are making decisions and sort of fear of the unknown type decisions in a way. But really, it's just yet another tool that humanity can have in its toolbox to make things a little bit easier. And so I don't see, certainly in those occupations that you've described as being at risk, I see people working smarter and perhaps easier, not being replaced in any great number, because there are components of those occupations which are not automatable or which will adapt to those tasks which have been.
So the question is really going to be, to what extent do those other components prove absolutely essential right. to the role that that person is currently filling, right? So in the case of the typing pool I mentioned before, those other things weren't essential. Social intelligence is often seen as something that's non-automatable and hence protective of occupations. But if you think about a lot of the places that we're interacting with a person, maybe we would be actually more willing to interact with an algorithm instead. David, you're very familiar with healthcare, and I keep wondering, in diagnosis, do we actually want to receive that information from a human doctor who's limited to a 10-minute consultation or something? Or would we instead prefer to receive it, you know, from an algorithm through digital means that has the space, the time to deliver all the information we could possibly want? And perhaps if it's an embarrassing diagnosis, you know, we'd prefer not to have the judgment of a human doctor.
I can imagine that there are certainly diseases and conditions that would fall into that category, perhaps not the life-threatening ones, but where you would want the verification of the human expert, that creative aspect, that part with insight that you described previously. You wouldn't want a machine that didn't have those components providing a diagnosis, I think, that was very, very serious. But absolutely, if it were a routine, lower level, more embarrassing condition, perhaps so.
Might these things not change? I mean, suppose, for example, that in some area of medical diagnosis, it not only becomes the case, but also becomes generally known that the algorithms do it more reliably than a human expert. I take it that's not completely impossible, at least in some areas. In that case, wouldn't the human expert become pretty much dispensable? I mean, at least that would no longer provide the reassurance element that you were talking about.
I think probably the most high-profile case at the moment is radiologists. There was even an Economist article on that saying, is the day of the radiologist over? And when you talk to radiologists, they sort of snigger at that. And they say, well, actually, that's just one component. It's one task of my occupation. And actually, if there's a tool that can automate this very dull process because I'm tired on a Friday afternoon, maybe I'm making an error, I think they're receptive to using those tools. Just like you're saying, they would adapt their job to use the things that are available. We've been taking electrocardiograms, monitoring the electrical capability of the heart for decades, and automated systems are now in use and people like to rely on those fairly regularly, particularly if it's in a low-skilled area. I think another not documented, hyped part of AI is what AI can do for improving access. So, for example, in my parochial field of healthcare, there's a big drive to creating AI systems that can help people in the developing world and people with less training to do more because those tools become available. If you've got a great radiology system, why don't you make it fully available?
In an area like that, I would expect that the sophistication of the knowledge of the healthcare worker is such that they're adding a lot more than just the judgment over the radiogram or whatever it is. And so having these tools to help them, to enable them to get through an awful lot more, to focus on the areas where their judgment is particularly valuable, that doesn't do them out of a job. It actually makes them far more efficient at dealing with more. But there must be areas where that's less clear. I mean, you gave the example, Mike, of preparing papers for tax. Now, there are a lot of people who've got expertise about finance and the relevant legal framework and so on, where an awful lot of their expertise really is just knowing what the rules are, and maybe the rules change year by year. That's dead easy to put into a computer system. When I'm doing my tax affairs, I don't want subtle human judgment. I just want to get it done as easily and cheaply as possible. Won't that at least be a threat to human employment?
So the key question here is about, you know, demand as well, right? So I think the interesting thing about healthcare, as David was suggesting, is that there is enormous latent demand for healthcare that really we need algorithms to begin to supply. So part of that is due to cost pressures, certainly acting on the NHS. Part of it is the changing demographics of our society. We're aging. We really want more healthcare as a result. And in the developing world, where David is very active, it's clear that, you know, technologies that absolutely essential if we're to deliver anything like a standard of healthcare that would be satisfactory. Yeah, the question is, across these different tasks, how much do we really want, right, as a society? In healthcare, we want a lot more. The technology is probably not going to substitute for healthcare workers, but just complement the labour they're delivering. In tax preparation, maybe that's not true. Maybe we've already kind of saturated demand.
Our main motivation is to reduce the amount of money we have to pay. And if I've got the option of paying a professional who's charging, you know, quite a lot per hour, and I've got a system, an automated system that I can get off the shelf for, you know, £10 or £20 or whatever, and it's going to do everything just fine, I've got no incentive whatever, have I, for going to the professional. So you'd see a major threat there.
That's right. Wherever there are these occupations that just involve that routine processing, storing, and perhaps making decisions upon data, you'd imagine that algorithmic solutions will come along.
This is pretty serious, right? Because the same is going to apply in a lot of areas of law, accountancy, all sorts. So, I mean, looking forward to the next 10, 20 years, I mean, your paper focused on automatability rather than what was actually going to happen. Let's focus a bit more on what's actually going to happen. We've already looked a bit at that with radiology and tax preparation. What else is going to be changing a lot?
We haven't yet talked about logistics, right? And the big ticket item here is the rise of autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. And there is a lot of work that involves moving things around in space in relatively routine sort of ways. So people often talk about taxi drivers as potentially being affected. But that's, you know, really at the far end of what's going to be possible with autonomous vehicle technology. The things that are much closer to home involve moving stuff around warehouses, which we've mentioned already. There are many other places where you can impose sufficient structure, by which I mean, you know, uniform conditions underfoot, uniform lighting, perhaps markers to indicate exactly where a robot should go, that these technologies will find a home much sooner. So factories, airports, even mines, where you have complete control of the environment to a high degree, these technologies are not just going to have impact, but are already having impact.
So just to be clear, here you're talking about areas where current technology is perfectly capable of doing the business.
That's right.
It's just a matter of rolling it out and preparing the ground and so forth.
Exactly.
Presumably, with the rate of change in machine learning techniques, if we give that another 10, 20 years, isn't it rather likely that many areas will become automatable even without going to all this length of preparation?
That's right, but we shouldn't understate the difficulties of getting to so-called level 5 autonomy, the requirement for a vehicle to be able to navigate, you know, difficult urban environments, for instance, to the same level that a human driver would be able to. I think that is still a very challenging problem, maybe not even one that's going to be solved by the end of the 2020s, but we don't need it to some degree to automate a lot of work.
I'd be glad to bring in Judy's historical perspective in here and allude back to something you said earlier, Mike. You were suggesting that some of these threats can be overblown because actually, although old jobs go, new ones come in their place, you've got a bigger pie to divide and there are losers, but there are more winners. And that's generally been the picture in the past?
Absolutely. If we go back to the Industrial Revolution, jobs were lost in spinning and weaving, but there were many jobs created in mechanical engineering. Mechanical engineering is not an occupation in the 18th century, but it becomes a big one in the 19th and 20th. Technology destroys and creates occupations, and its application does. I'd like to just look at how that happens, though, and maybe use the example of the radiologists again. To use AI effectively as a radiologist, one needs to get new routines, you know, new working practices in place. And the effectiveness with which the professional or the trained person, you know, the person with the expertise from a kind of human and a machine perspective can utilize that technology has a lot to do with how long they've been in the position, how much they're paid, the kind of job security they have, and the sort of investment that they might like to make personally in that position and in that use of technology. And that is where the challenge becomes, because what you're talking about is for the owners of businesses or the NHS or capital generally, it presents organizational challenges around the way that employment is organized, contracts, pay, hours, all those sorts of things. And those are disruptive. And those issues can be even more contentious than the actual loss of occupations or creation of them.
Could you spell out a little bit more how some of those various factors play out?
Well, you were sort of presenting a very positive view of the opportunities that AI, you know, holds. Basically, we can process, you know, very complex and important information much faster than we would. And this would enable, in the radiology case, more diagnoses to be well made, and so more people to be treated better and quicker further down the line. But that can only happen if those decisions can be made. If the person interpreting the results of the AI algorithm are not in a position to pass people on for more treatment or to make further decisions that would take things to the next level, or the investment for treatment isn't there, then we can't benefit. So the outcome of better learning, better technology and sort of, you know, intelligence, artificial intelligence in the workplace should be that we can move on to the next stage of whatever the task, you know, or the process related to work is. But if investment is not made into the next stage, then we can't progress and literally jobs are.
Just going to add, don't we also have a social duty to use some of these technologies?
Yes.
If they are simply better? I'm thinking
Absolutely.
Of the workhouse. Nobody would want those conditions to persist. It's entirely appropriate that mechanical engineers and their inventions, you know, remove a lot of suffering from the world. So I think that, you know, that's
the potential. The issue is that these questions, the questions of displacement and occupational displacement, have not always been dealt with well by society as a whole, because there is a strong tradition, particularly in this country, of viewing occupational change as a loss. And that is, you know, as a deadweight loss, you know, and modernity and progress as robbing people of skills. The idea that the Industrial Revolution was a de-skilling process is still very prevalent. You know, the evidence says that's not the case, but it's a sort of an attractive story and people cling on to that as a result. And that story then helps create some of the fear around AI.
My impression is that the real problem of the English Industrial Revolution was not necessarily a reduction in the number of jobs, but the quality of jobs, right? Yeah. So there was a potential loss of income for a lot of workers. I've heard estimates that it took 60 to 70 years for real wages to increase at all for the majority of English workers. Are those fears legitimate?
Yes. Most people did not benefit from the Industrial Revolution in the classic sense until after 1860. Whereas the key innovations and investments were made 100 years before that in the 1760s and 1770s. So the process of organizational change that accompanied the technological change did not distribute those gains evenly. And a lot of that was to do with the way that employment was structured. That is the workers' experience of industrialization, is low-grade factory work. Mechanization brings about repetition, long hours, factory discipline, which is feared and loathed by workers and becomes a cause around which a new working class consciousness begins to agitate. A lot of early industrialized work was incredibly low skilled. And what we know is that actually the English workforce de-skilled dramatically throughout the late 18th and early 19th century. Fewer people were working at levels above semi-skilled or skilled, and more people were working in unskilled occupations until the late 19th century when that began to turn. So the process takes a very long time. You know, this is something that's going to play out over 50 years to a century rather than over a decade. So 2030 is very close. We won't actually know much about what's happening by 2030, I would say.
And isn't there a huge difference here in the sort of timescales involved? I mean, when new equipment or new technology was coming in earlier times, it took time for that technology to be produced, to be mass produced, to be taken on in different geographical areas and so on. If new techniques come in through machine learning to automate some area of work, that can come in almost instantaneously right around the world and at a low price, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to pay a computer the minimum wage.
Absolutely. It could do, but you need to pay the person who's going to work with the computer. I mean, because, you know, unless we're talking about, and I don't get the feeling there's a vision here that the computers are going to be running the shop.
No.
So what determines the uptake or the speed at which technology is introduced is how capital decides to invest. And what we do know from the first and the second and the third industrial revolutions is that it tends to be very industry specific. So textiles, almost very, very quickly, within 20 to 30 years, textile production in this country was automated. And that was quick at the end of the 18th century, and we would find it quick today as well. And that was simply nobody would invest in old style production anymore. You could not get investment. And a little bit like if you get backing for a business or any kind of startup today, if it doesn't have a technological element to it, if there isn't an app, as it were, you're not going to get capital for it. It's capital that puts, if you like, the energy or a lot of the kind of fuel behind the implementation of these ideas. And so it will be capital that determines the speed at which these things are taken up. And by capital, I mean the people who decide how to invest and where to spend capital expenditure money on sort of balance sheets.
Isn't that an argument that, in fact, machine learning might be implemented relatively quickly
because
there is so much capital available right now for machine learning?
So it could be very, very quick indeed. I think the stuff that isn't so quick is this occupational displacement. So history suggests that that's really difficult, that that's a process of bargaining. And one of the things that's worrying today is that we're not very good at bargaining, particularly labour bargaining. In fact, it's something that society in Western countries hasn't had to do for about 50 years now.
Can I come back on that? A bargaining process requires that the participants have something to bargain with.
Yes.
Now, what seems to me to be different potentially about this industrial revolution as opposed to the others? With the others, what you have is typically relatively routine skills being taken over by machines. And suddenly a single human being can do a lot more, can be a lot more productive. You still need their input to be productive. They are still of considerable economic value. Now, the worry about artificial intelligence is that that is actually providing a lot of the decision making as well.
Yes.
So the number of people you need to employ in the very high level cognitive role is small. And actually, the best way of getting them is to get very highly trained young people who have grown up in that world and been tailored towards those skills. And the older people basically become potentially useless. The worry is that economically, as far as the employers are concerned, they are worth less in terms of their input than what the employer would have to pay them. And they've got nothing left to bargain with. And there are plenty of areas of the economy where you could see them doing very valuable things. For example, healthcare, looking after our old people, our young people, and all the rest. But if all the profits from the automation mm-hmm. are going to the people who own the computer systems and so yeah. on, they're not going to the people who need to pay for the healthcare and, you know, for granny to be looked after and so on, then there's no automatic mechanism here that's going to bring about anything like a fair distribution.
Absolutely. In order to bargain these sorts of problems into workable outcomes, you need institutions. And by institutions, I mean organizations or agreements or legislation where everybody agrees these are the means by which the problem gets resolved. The old way of doing these things actually took, there's a very clear sort of trajectory really from the Statute of Artificers right through to 1909 and the Trade Board Acts, which finally says, okay, we've worked out this wage and occupation thing, and the market works for the majority of people, but it doesn't work for the bottom 15%. And that's what the Trade Board Acts is going to do. And it's Churchill who actually brings in wage setting at the bottom of the market in the industries where the bargain hasn't worked, where people are, you know, working for less than subsistence because that's all they are worth to an employer. So the Trade Board Acts is an admission that the labour market needs help and that bargains need to be worked out on a regional, governmental and employer level. But that allows then the 20th century paradigm of wages and prices and sort of monetary and the fiscal economy, you know, the kind of Keynesian paradigm, to exist and to be theorised and to be predicted and modelled. The only thing is we completely unpicked the labour side of that in the late 1970s and early 1980s. You know, we don't have a mechanism for wage bargaining anymore in this country. There are some employers and some occupations where there is a good labour representation, particularly, you know, and there are some where...
You mean trade unions?
Yes. Well, so there are some, there are still some, you know, and there are other types of board of professional organisations that bargain in another way. But generally, most people do not have an organisation or an institution to bargain for them. And so because we have let those institutions lapse, we are actually in a bit of a crisis because individuals, history suggests, are, you know, have no power in labour bargaining situations. So yes, they will lose out. And if the state, government, regions, whatever we want to call them, are not willing to say that part of the profits of automation should be brought back into society through some means of taxation, whatever, you know, levy, whatever you want to call it, then, you know, and that profit moves to some offshore fund, which is the only profitable way of funding these things, then there will be a severe, you know, fracture. It's a fracture in the social contract, essentially, because the fiscal state, you know, is not taking its part in the process of work and productivity.
I first wanted to challenge something you said, Peter. You said that young people might be the beneficiaries of technological change, but actually in the professions, people seem to be more concerned that, in fact, young people will be unable to get a foot on the ladder because a lot of the kind of routine tasks that were the entry to those professions are being removed by automation. So I don't think it's entirely clear. But the more interesting thing to discuss is Judy's point about bargaining power. So my impression is that technological change has actually been part of why workers have lost bargaining power, and that, you know, information technology has moved us more to independent work, to freelancing, and with the rise of more advanced information technologies, now we have algorithms acting as managers, kind of segregating workers from one another. Do you think that's credible? And if so, what can we possibly do about it without throwing these technologies away?
I think that is credible. I think, you know, legislation.
Right.
And, you know, the kind of political economic framework has actually taken many of those rights away. There was a conscious decision within the political, you know, framework to curb the bargaining power of unions because they were responsible for sclerotic growth, or lack of growth, in the 1970s and for basically a sort of huge holdup in productivity. The bargain had failed. And they also only represented pretty much half the workforce, men, at that time. So, you know, unions had, you know, weren't working. That doesn't mean that the idea of unions was bad. Technology has fragmented the experience of work because it has brought about, you know, people into lots of different locations. You know, people don't tend to work in one big place, centralized place anymore where they can see their co-workers and where they can see the hierarchy and where they can sort of work with it and understand it. So technology is definitely part of the reason for that, but it's not the only one. I think there's a huge complementarity between some of the kind of you know, social trends in, you know, the fragmentation of work and technology, but I'm not sure there's a causal relationship.
So one thing I find interesting is that technology has not been taken up more by workers, right? I mean, you would think technology would enable workers to organise more effectively than has been possible in the past. Why has technology ended up biasing power towards the employers rather than the employees? I don't really understand that.
Well, this is, I mean, if you think about the original job sites, you know, Monster and original sort of HR, you know, online, the huge question has always been, why wasn't it information sharing of, you know, workers? Why didn't someone go, I've just got 50 grand for doing this? You know what I mean? Are you on that? You know what I mean? Why didn't the app manage that? I think probably the failure of the unions to be actual cooperative type organisations rather than hierarchical structure has something to do with it, but it's under-researched. It's a very good
the things
point.
I'm quite a fan of is things like Glassdoor and Rate My Professor, which obviously I have an interest in these personally. Presumably those are a very good tool for the worker in terms of representation and equality of terms.
They being, should be.
In terms of applying for a new job, you can, you know, get a very realistic estimate of what work is like there.
Yes, you get, but you're relying on the information that's declared on the platform being good. You know, there's always an information asymmetry between insiders and outsiders, and that probably remains the case.
Is there a more fundamental point here, though? You've been talking as though it's a failure in the competitive market, as it were. Something has failed with regard to the bargaining power of workers, and if they could only get a mechanism that would make things work better, they'd be okay. I want to suggest that it may be more fundamental than that. It may be that actually the bottom line is that there are too many workers in competition for too few jobs, and that puts them against each other in a way that doesn't apply for the employers. So in other words, it's not like if they had a better mechanism, that would solve it. What do you think, Judy?
Generally, I think I agree. So most labour markets are monopsonistic, as in, you know, the employer or employers set the deal, the wages, and it's much easier for employers to collude on those deals than it is for labour to collude. There's a simple numbers game, as in you might meet another worker. The chances of them being like you are less than the chances of two employers being like each other. That's a fundamental problem in labour markets in perpetuity. The way that the labour market is currently structured in terms of the way that we take up and leave jobs probably makes that worse. Yeah. One thing that should be highlighted here is the notion of job is really new. Mm-hmm. There was no such thing until the early 19th century. People had work that lasted for a while or didn't. They had lots of different types of work. Some people had positions. Some people, you know, were agents or whatever. But the idea of a job is a very modern phenomenon and might well disappear.
It was something we fought for as workers.
Yes. Well, job security. And essentially, you know, there's a choice, you know, from the Reform Acts onwards, there's a choice that Labour, you know, faces, you know, as organisations, as unions. And that is to, you know, to bargain for every, you know, for every piece of work, to basically, you know, lock in as equals with employers and, you know, to kind of bid, counterbid, or to accept job security and factory discipline. And Labour takes factory discipline and job security. And it doesn't really happen for everybody until the 19th century, but it is what the unions decide is the better deal.
I think one thing that concerns me is the atomization of work. So things like Mechanical Turk and, you know, equivalent regimes where work is fragmented down into small packets which can be farmed out to people. You know, it's almost a race to the bottom. If you let the market decide, then the supply and demand laws will mean that those prices go down very quickly because there's so many people willing to do it. Yeah. If you let the market decide, doesn't that just lead to everybody being on zero-hour contracts, atomization, etc.? What
history suggests, yes. That's a piece rate. And that's that. The piece rate is how everybody is paid for everything. I mean, apart from a few choice workers, until the mid-19th century. You're not paid for your time. You're paid for what you produce. So, you know, in that model, the idea is that labour are taking on the risk of seasonality, the risks of finance, the risks of supply and demand not meeting up. That's what piece rate work is, and that is hugely precarious.
And that gets solved to a large extent by union action, does it?
But because the workers club together, the 19th century is about the workers clubbing together and going, actually, we'll take the time and we'll take job security. It may be more difficult for us then to bargain for rate.
Sure, but the employers need to fit in with that because otherwise they're not going to have workers to deliver.
But employers, right. There's the incentive for employers in the 19th century is to have a regular supply of labour.
Right.
Because once the machines are turned on, you need people to turn up.
Right. We've been learning lessons from the past. We want to
see
how that's playing out in the future. And I want to suppose you have a system where at the very high level you need humans to make strategic decisions, but an awful lot of the information processing that would have been done in previous centuries by humans is actually taken over by AIs. The number of people you need to employ is relatively tiny. The amount of stuff of business you're generating is huge because it's global. Loads and loads of this is automated. You've got lots of people vying for these high-level jobs, which are presumably pretty well paid and sought after. You're not worried by competition between the workers because there are so many of them vying for them and so few jobs. Doesn't the employer hold all the cards?
Yes.
Right. So
you're describing the 17th century. Yes. Yes.
But unlike in the 17th century, where there was a potential solution in terms of workers getting together, what's the solution now? What do we need to do? Is it only political action that's going to make a difference?
Okay, this isn't a new thing. But studying this suggests that really workers getting together is kind of the only way. That doesn't mean that we need to revive the old trade unions, but we need to hand power, maybe legislative or other, and information to workers. And that requires workers actually working together and having some kind of,
I think that worked in previous centuries, but with globalization, how can that feasibly take place?
Well, isn't technology exactly the answer here?
Yeah, technology could be the answer.
We are all in touch with people across the globe. Surely there is this unfilled gap for technology that enables labor to organize.
But how does that work? I mean, suppose for every 1,000 potential workers, you've got, 100 jobs or maybe only 10 jobs going. How are you going to persuade those 1,000 people that they should all insist on such and such conditions from the employers or the people with...
That's essentially exactly the same problem as faced in 1832 or 1848 or 1867. That's exactly the same problem. There's always a labour aristocracy, and actually it is in the interests of labour aristocracy to turn around and get the rest of the labour movement behind them and campaign for better hours for everybody. When most people are working and working productively, the economy works for more people than if few people are working and there's large volumes of...
Vast majority of the work, the actual physical work, including logistics and paperwork, administrative stuff, all that lot is all being done by AI.
I think also there's an assumption in what you're saying that this is going to lead to a rise in unemployment, that there are going to be more people who have nothing, no work to do. And although that sounds intuitively correct, that's the thing that all of the indicators, all of the numbers in the long run say is the opposite of what happens. There will be more work, but the quality of it and the occupations that it's in might not be what we like or what we have experience of.
So I agree actually with Judy that that's what we're likely to see even in the coming decades. So yes, there will be tasks, maybe even occupations that disappear due to automation. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that are not going to be non-automatable, but are going to actually increase in demand as a result of other changes in society. And we've seen that recently in the rise of so-called artisanal work. So people, well-paid professionals, are more willing to go to fancy coffee shops, for instance, which creates work for barristers?
barristers.
Right, sorry. Apologies. And, well-paid tech professionals have the cash to burn on things like laundry services and dog groomers and so on. The, there will be money that flows into new forms of work, even to existing forms of work. It's not that there is not going to be sufficient demand for even relatively low-skilled work in the future.
Well, OK, I do want to challenge this a little bit. First of all, if lots of those wealthy workers who currently populate the City of London are themselves going to be put out of work because a lot of their skills become obsolete, right? Lawyers, accountants, financial traders, algorithms can do their job better, let's say, in, you know, 10 years.
Can I challenge that assumption? Because actually we've already in a lot of these professions seen a lot of technological change and a lot of automation that hasn't resulted in net unemployment. So the City of London is an excellent example where technology has completely changed the type of work that people do, but it's not that there have been lots of unemployed traders, for instance. People at the high-skilled end of the spectrum seem to be able to adapt to changes in technology and actually become more productive as a result. They're better complemented by technological change.
I'd like to back Mike up on that. I think the future, when it arrives, is surprisingly mundane and extremely boring. And everybody's used to our daily life being suffused with all sorts of AI already. And that's just, has it put people out of employment? It's just adapted the way that the way in which it works. I think we come back to that point that what is possible is relatively prosaic. What we now see as being incredibly exciting will be very, very dull when it arrives because we'll be so well acclimatized to it and jobs will have already adapted and shifted in advance.
It sounds like I'm in a minority here, but I'm going to press my pessimism a little bit further. Okay, let's not think about the overall size of the pie, but the distribution of it. And let me take what seem to me to be two pretty obvious cases. So on the one hand, you have global tech corporations, you know, now worth a trillion and counting, hoovering up huge amounts of business. Amazon, for example, putting a lot of shops apparently out of business, or at least making it very difficult for them. That's concentrating wealth into a relatively small number of hands. Now, at the other end, take a task for which there will surely be ever-increasing need, and that is care of the elderly, where having the personal touch, the empathy, and so on is so valuable. And we can all see that if a significant amount of the money that's going to these huge corporations were somehow to get into the system so that it could pay for people to help look after the elderly, that would be great. But it's not going to happen because the money isn't going in the right place. The people who would need to pay for the care, be they families or councils or whatever, are not getting the money that is being hoovered up by the big corporations. And the local shops aren't getting it either, so the tax take is going down, etc., etc. What I'm saying is, I can see a good argument, maybe for the overall pie increasing, because AI enables a lot more economic activity, huge efficiency by the people who are actually using those systems. I can't see how it's going to solve the problems for what we need at the bottom end.
I think you're touching on two separate, very big challenges, current challenges. The first is the fiscal state is losing its grip on taxing production. That's something to do with technology, but it's also something to do with globalization of information and capital generally. The assumption is that capital will go to the place that the lowest tax rate is at. So, you know, it's all going to converge on the Cayman Islands. So we have to just tax them lightly so they stay here, chaps, is the kind of thinking. That's a generalized problem about production of any kind, whether AI is involved or not. The other issue is about then the organization of care and social care and healthcare within the state, and whether the financial burden of that should rest on the individual or whether it should be collectivised through either some insurance mechanism or through the state and some insurance mechanism. And again, we're at a kind of bit of a juncture in terms of our thinking. You know, if 1948 and the NHS said it shall all be collectivised in the state, that problem or that solution is being challenged. And that's not for reasons to do with AI. That's for reasons to do with, you know, the state as an outsourcer, you know, which is a big U-shape, you know, since kind of Tudor period. The question about whether the profits from artificial intelligence should be taken by, you know, the community as large to pay for social care or, you know, social issues like that is a much bigger one than just taxation. And then that's something that I think you're absolutely right to point out, because we're not dealing with how the profits from production shall be distributed. But that's the framework that we have at the moment, and it doesn't necessarily draw a relationship between AI. At the end of the day, there is some state investment that has a right, you know, that is responsible for AI in terms of military, you know, the military investments in technology from the mid 20th century, you know, are all in our little phones, apparently. But the money for those investments to become reality is not being invested by states at the moment. Mm. And our model of capitalism, our model of investment, our model of everything is dependent on the investors being able to take a return from those. So we need to fundamentally think about globally, not just in one particular jurisdiction, about whether that is still the right deal.
Are you hinting that one of the things we need to think about also is intellectual property?
Absolutely. Because at the moment, IP is rooted in individual countries. There isn't a sort of global accord. And that needs to change if we're going to deal with the taxation problem, or, you know, all those kind of things as well.
So I think a key word here is intangibles.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah,
so the AI is just the kind of tip of a much bigger iceberg of the move towards an economy that's based not around the production of atoms, you know, physical things, but relies instead on, you know, a sort of production of knowledge. And, you know, the success of firms is based on these very difficult to measure things within the firm, you know, the culture of a firm, for instance, and not even its IP, but its sort of way of doing things. As Judy has been saying, that does kind of motivate these big challenges that we don't have immediate solutions to.
Yeah, and it's not getting easier to get international agreement, is it, these days?
I think it's not getting easier to start a conversation about the social contract. You know, which the you know, what the deal between the state, individuals and business is. That's actually a very, very hard conversation to start on a, you know, a level playing field at the moment, because there are so many interests and it's such a sort of hot topic. But that's the one that needs to start, possibly.
So a question for you, Judy. Do you see any other nations that are doing this better? So I have this impression that the Nordic countries, for instance, have a better track record of involving labour in...
The Nordic countries always have a better track record of involving everybody, absolutely. But, you know, they've got a track record of, you know, lots of other things that aren't so positive. Essentially, the kind of the mechanism for redistribution and sharing of the gains from production or capitalism have always been dealt with in a different way there with different institutions. I think the German model, which allows, you know, which brings private enterprise, finance and regional kind of and labour government together, is also good at dealing with this. The Anglo-American model has always been very, you know, one way, kind of a swing of the pendulum, as it were. And that may have brought us very high levels of investment and foreign direct investment, you know, and it's been a good place for AI and technology to be invested in some ways. But it has costs. At the end of the day, the Nordic model is what we are leaving behind. I mean, essentially, the Anglo-American side of things has rejected social democracy as a means of running the state. I mean, that we've turned away from that for a moment. Whether we turn back towards it or not is the biggest question.
If we've got a world in which essentially the countries that are thriving economically or doing most spectacularly well economically tend to be ones in which they're letting the free market rip. The corporations that we have are thriving from that, and they're increasingly having control over, or at least they are facilitating a lot of the communications media that are influencing people. And at the same time, we've got a complete absence of international agreement about all sorts of very basic things. We have, you know, China and Russia pursuing very different agendas. Can you see any prospect for progress here within the foreseeable future?
Just to remain positive, because, you know, where does a no lead us at this point? There is an opportunity in, I think it's exciting to see what's happening with the way that the big technology companies are responding to the idea that social media and that the information sharing should be regulated. And that provides, that I think is offering a dialogue that might just pull in labour or, you know, wider audiences to participation and information sharing for the purposes of, you know, better employment and social outcomes. So that holds out a hope.
It sounds like a pretty key role here, maybe in making people in general aware of these issues and aware that we need to have this conversation. We can't just go on as before, expecting that everything's going to come out in the Panglossian way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. So hopefully the podcast will help.
Yeah. Let's hope. Well, maybe we should wrap up now. And I'll invite each of you to just sum up where you see things being now, where you see them going in the next 10 or 20 years and the further future. David, let's start with you.
Thank you. I'm an optimist. I think there's a rosy future. As I said before, I think the future is very boring when it arrives. And I think because we're so well adapted to these things, I think society is going to change positively. My family historically have been cow farmers back to the Doomsday Book. And since the automation and collectivization of that industry, there's been a change to farming in a different way, providing unusual beef stock and interesting meats in an artisanal way that Mike referred to. As a society, we're very good at adapting to change. I think we can do more with less with AI. So certainly that's one of the starting points, what I do in healthcare. We can increase access. We can do things better in financially constrained circumstances, such as social care, such as care of the elderly. My father has just gone into a care home. And every time I go and visit him, I think of all the great things actually that AI and technology could do to make everybody's lives better in that environment. And that's not a race to the bottom. I think that's a very positive message.
Thank you. Judy?
I share a lot of the optimism because I think the tools at our disposal are so powerful and so interesting. What history teaches us is that humans and society communally, we have choices to make about how we use resources like this. And what is increasingly striking is how ill-prepared we are currently to make those choices because we haven't started having the debate. I think I've pointed out earlier the lack of bargaining institutions to make work and pay better. That's a crisis waiting to unfold. So what I hope very much so is that those institutions and debates about how to form them start to come up. And if AI is the thing that encourages people to think about how work works within society, then so much the better.
Thank you. Mike?
So I describe myself as a nervous optimist. So obviously I work in the field of machine learning. I wouldn't do so if ultimately I felt that it wasn't to the net benefit of humankind. So I completely agree with David that there are all these benefits to be had from the technology. But at the same time, a lot of our own work has been trying to identify the potential risks, if not to society as a whole, at least to some sectors of workers. And if that's not unemployment, it could at least be in reduced working conditions, such as a reduction in income. I think that's a very real risk. So exactly as Judy was saying, I see technology as political. And the only way that we're going to get the best out of it as a society is if we have the kind of discussions that Judy has identified.
Many thanks to Mike Osborne, Judy Stevenson, and David Clifton for what has been a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion, an excellent start to our first series of Future Makers. And thank you for joining us. If you've got any questions or suggested topics for us, please do get in touch on Twitter at Uni of Oxford, all one word. And if you've enjoyed this episode, we'd be very grateful for a review on the podcast app of your choice. Next time we're here, we'll be discussing whether algorithms are biased. So do make sure you join us then. I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.